Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Carolina law professor Eric Muller's new book, it's his book, collects an incredible set of photos shot by a Japanese-American in one of the World War II intern camps that you've heard about. This book has gained praise across the country, and Professor Muller has agreed to come and talk to us about his book, which is called Colors of Confinement, Rare Kodachrome Photographs of Japanese-American Incarceration in World War II.
It's a mouthful.
A short title. Let me just, Eric, first of all, welcome.
Thanks for coming. Thank you, and thanks so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
You know, this is extraordinary. In one sense, you've just collected a bunch of 70-year-old photographs, kind of a family amateur photographs happen to be in color, and you put them into a book, and it's sensational in terms of the reaction that it's getting across the country.
Yeah,
what's going on?
Well, it's been surprising. There's been coverage of the book, and you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the UK Daily Mail, the Asahi Shimbun in Japan. There's remarkable. Outpouring of interest in these photographs. And I mean, I'd love to say that it's my scholarship and my writing that, and the other essays by a couple of other scholars that are really drawing the attention. But to be honest with you, DG, it's photographs, and that it's photographs that hit you in a place that you're not expecting in a couple of ways. The most obvious way is that these are color photographs shot by a Japanese American in 1942 and 1943. Until I learned about these photographs, did not know that color photography existed in the early 1940s. I, and maybe many of your listeners, are probably accustomed to thinking of the world
of black and white experience.
Yeah, it was a black and white world. It's sort of like Kansas at the beginning of The Wizard of Oz. You know, it just exists in black and white. And so it's just nothing short of stunning to see a world that we're accustomed to seeing in black and white in our mental images all of a sudden unfold in beautiful color. So that's one way in which I think it's just really turning people's heads. The other way is that, I think at this point those of us who spend any time thinking about this time period have developed a way of thinking about it and a way of imagining the injustice and the suffering that this community
endured. Excuse me for interrupting you, but I grew up sort of during these times and during the times of reflection about it, but give us just a little basic introduction to the internship experience from the time of Pearl Harbor on.
Right. I'll try to do this quickly. Japanese people had been immigrating to the United States from the late 19th century. And had come to the United States and both Hawaii and mostly the West Coast. They were not allowed to become U.S. citizens at the time because American law forbade that. You had to be either white or of African ancestry to become a citizen at that time. So there was a whole immigrant generation living along the West Coast, and then that immigrant generation had children. Their children were U.S. citizens because they were born here. And the 14th Amendment says you're a citizen if you're born here. There was, for a variety of reasons, a great deal of resentment that grew up along the West Coast towards Asians generally and towards the Japanese in particular. Very complex set of reasons having to do with military expansionism on the part of Japan, having to do with a great deal of economic envy directed towards Japanese farmers in particular because they were so incredibly successful along the coast, and including in places where white farmers had never really had a whole lot of success. There was a fairly racist image of Asians generally and the Japanese in particular that depicted them as being sort of a different breed of human being, just somehow not capable of assimilating into America in the same way that, say, a person from Norway or Germany or England would be. So you had this very potent mix of racism and economic resentment and military fears. All of this explodes as the bombs drop on Pearl Harbor. That sneak attack on Pearl Harbor triggers a bunch of different reactions. Obviously, the military is very concerned about what's happened to a big chunk of the Pacific Fleet. In the meantime, the public, and in particular the Hearst newspapers, are very interested in drumming up a great deal of fear and hysteria about this sneaky enemy that has launched this attack and that has designs on Los Angeles and has designs on San Francisco and plans on invading the West Coast.
It's a fifth column idea.
Fifth column, right. So they're going to, you know, next thing we know, submarines are going to land at Santa Barbara and hordes of Japanese soldiers are going to come climbing out of submarines and will be joined by American-born people, you know, Japanese Americans, people born in the United States, but to Japanese parents, and of course to the Japanese resident aliens as well. So at the same time, you've got all the farmers who for years had been trying to kick the Japanese out. They start screaming to their congressmen that the moment has finally come to get rid of this Japanese menace. And the military, which was initially pretty cool to the idea of uprooting every person of Japanese ancestry along the coast, and even the Justice Department, which absolutely opposed the idea of removing American citizens, eventually the public pressures became so strong that the military began to change their tune. Early January of 1942, the commander at the Presidio in San Francisco begins to come under a great deal of pressure principally by politicians to do something about the quote-unquote Japanese problem. So there's a long battle that erupts between the military on the one hand and the Justice Department on the other hand, with the military moving towards the idea that every person of Japanese ancestry, citizen or alien, needs to be rounded up and removed from the coast. And the Justice Department, the Attorney General at the time, Francis Biddle, and that great protector of civil liberties, J. Edgar Hoover, insisting that was unnecessary and illegal and that the problem could be handled in a much narrower way. But the military gets the upper hand with President Roosevelt. Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of War at the time, ultimately gets Franklin Roosevelt's approval to give the military blanket authority to remove any person from a military zone. And the military, that happens in February of 42. The military then deploys that in a very race-conscious way. So they immediately begin to develop plans to remove every person of Japanese ancestry, aliens and citizens, from the entire strip of the West Coast, from all the way up from Seattle all the way down to actually tiny little
places. There would have been an uproar from the civil liberties community that could not be stopped. Did anything like that happen?
No, nothing like that happened. The only outcry that really came from an organized group was from the Quakers. The Quakers were really the only group that spoke in a really focused way against this. There were some political leaders, and I'm very proud to say, including our own Frank Porter Graham, who joined to protest this move towards mass removal and mass incarceration in the spring of 42.
Was this based on a perceived military threat? That is the fifth column type idea that the people of Japanese ancestry on the coast would be flashing signals and providing military intelligence to the Japanese. Is that what carried the day?
Well, the stated explanation that the military presented somewhat after the fact was grounded in military necessity. The thought was, yes, that or the stated thought was that if there were attacks along the West Coast, if there was an invasion, the word invasion kept getting used over and over and over and again. In the event of a Japanese invasion, because and again, I'm not inserting this word in a hindsight way. The report itself in the spring of 42 said there is a racial risk here. That even for the second generation, even for the citizens who were born in this country to Japanese parents, they carry the racial strains from their parents that would lead them risk being disloyal to the United States and engage in subversive activity. The thought was not, we don't have enough time to sift through individual by individual. The thought was, because of these racial differences, it's impossible to know who's loyal and who's disloyal. And since we can't know with this group, we really have no choice as a precaution but to uproot them. Now, behind the scenes, DG, it must be remembered that a great deal of the pressure for this was actually not coming from the military intelligence services. It wasn't coming from G2 within the Army. It wasn't coming from the Office of Naval Intelligence. It was coming from the congressional delegations of California and Oregon and Washington. And it was coming from the newspapers, and it was coming from columnists, you know, the commentators of that day, were speaking with pretty much one voice that, you know, this was a huge, huge risk to the coast and needed to be
responded to. Well, was there ever, I don't know the answer to the question, but was there ever any evidence of, I mean, surely there was some disloyal Japanese. I mean, you know, you would have found a Caucasian who'd be willing to spy for the Japanese under certain circumstances. I mean, so were there?
There was never a documented instance of Japanese American subversion.
What about in Hawaii, where, you know, there are a whole lot more Japanese in Hawaii, and there was a real attack on that. On Hawaii, was there ever any evidence of collaboration or spying?
There were rumors of such. There was never anything really documented, with the exception of a couple of people who were employees of the Japanese consulate in Honolulu. And there was one incident in which a Japanese warplane crashed on an island. I think this was just after Pearl Harbor, and it's not entirely clear what happened, but it's said that a couple of Japanese resident aliens assisted or provided some cover for or quarter to the pilot who had been downed.
Well, I'm fascinated in the history, but the real crux of your book is grounded in the history. So let's take a break and then come back and talk about if anybody joined us late, the fantastic collections of photographs and what they tell us, photographs of the internship, of one internship camp and the families there and what those photographs tell us today. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Professor Eric Muller. He's a professor, I should say, the Dan K. Moore professor.
Because that's right.
When I was young, I was an intern in his office.
Is that
so
right?
Governor Moore. You're the Dan K. Moore Distinguished Professor in Jurisprudence and Ethics at the University of North Carolina. And there's more to it. Director of the Center for Faculty Excellence,
right,
and more. I mean, let's just don't go there, but there's more. We can find it on the web pages. But what we're talking about is, I guess, I don't want to call it a hobby of yours. It's a passion of yours that has to do with the incident, the historical events that we've been talking about, and their legal, what they teach us or what they can teach us, and the kinds of issues we have to wrestle with today.
Mm-hmm.
But we can talk about some of those if you want to. But what I'd like for you to talk about are the pictures, the photographs, and the person who took them.
Sure.
And his story.
You bet. So, you know, after the president signed this executive order, it was a matter of months before every person of Japanese ancestry along the coast was forced out of their homes and forced behind barbed wire. They spent the summer of 1942 in basically these hastily thrown together prison camps. Along the West Coast, prison camps that were thrown together at racetracks and fairgrounds, big public places, kind of like the places like where the North Carolina State Fair is about to be held.
Or you know what struck me is the confinement areas that developed after Katrina, where you just didn't have anything to do down in New Orleans.
So that's where they spent the summer of 42, and then in the fall of 42, this group of about 120,000 people was rolled out to one of 10 permanent so-called relocation centers. That's the euphemism that the government created for these incarceration facilities. The one that is depicted in these photographs is the Heart Mountain Relocation Center, which is up in northwest Wyoming. It's not far from Yellowstone National Park. It's about 60 miles east of the east entrance to Yellowstone.
I told you we wouldn't do background anymore, but now part of the background is what happened to these people's homes, and you mentioned that many of them were farmers. What happened? I mean, did they just pulled out? They just left them in the fallow?
Generally speaking, people had about 2 weeks' notice, 2 to 3 weeks' notice that their time had come to be removed, to be evicted from their homes. So people did what they could to get their worldly goods together. Many people were forced to just pretty much leave a lot of their stuff behind. And they came home years later and found that everything had been ransacked and stolen, of course. Some families tried to get some of their personal property together and maybe store it in a local church or store it with a white neighbor or rent a storage facility, and again, those people tended to find that pretty much everything was gone by the time they got back. Japanese resident aliens tended not to own their farmland because they weren't allowed to under the law of the state of California. California, like many states at that time, have what were called alien land laws. So if you were an alien who couldn't become a citizen, you also were not allowed to own land. So sometimes they would title it in the names of their U.S. citizen children, but many of them were holding leases for their farmland. They would own the crops and they would own the outbuildings and so on, but they wouldn't own the land itself. But you you pretty much had to leave it all behind. You had to the photographer was a guy named Bill Manbo, and his wife's family were farmers in Norwalk, California, just outside of L.A. They grew a bunch of different truck crops, vegetables, but principally rhubarb. And so when their number came up in the spring of 42, they pretty much just had to leave the rhubarb crop right there in the field, negotiated a deal with their landlord that the landlord would care for the rhubarb and market it while they were gone, and then share in the profits and then return them to their lease once they got back. So, basically people, there's very moving photographs, not in this collection, but from others, of people, holding firehouse sales, selling things for pennies on the dollar because they really just had to pretty much pack up and move out. And they could only take what they could carry, physically carry. So, if you had a car, if you had a bicycle, if you had sofas and beds and linens and, that stuff, you either sold it or you left it behind.
Well, what about Bill Manbo, the photographer? What was his he wasn't a farmer, was he?
He was not a farmer. Bill Manbo was in this U.S. citizen generation.
So for anybody who joined us late, you pointed out that those who had been born, those who were like, say, 20 years old and younger, or 22 years old and younger, they were citizens.
They were citizens of the United States because they had been born here. Their parents were aliens and had to remain so because they were not allowed to naturalize under U.S. law. And in fact, the U.S. cut off all immigration.
So there were no new immigrants.
That's right. After 1924, there were no new immigrants coming from Japan. So basically anybody like, for example, Bill Manbo's parents or his mother and father-in-law, the farmers, they had all been in the United States for decades already by the time of Pearl Harbor. Bill Manbo was born in the United States, grew up in the United States, went to Hollywood High School, went to the Frank Wiggins Trade School to learn how to be an auto mechanic. That's where he met his wife, Mary. She was studying to be a seamstress there. They got married. He opened up a garage in Hollywood, and he serviced people's cars. That's what he was doing.
Interesting. I'll show you my racist background, but I mean, you look at Bill Manbo, and how do I say this? He's ambiguous in terms of his race. You could argue that he looked almost Hispanic. I mean, those are just my eyes, but it looked like he'd been Americanized almost.
Well,
and pushed aside some of the genetic.
I don't know
that happened.
I don't know.
And he was big and, he looked strong.
Yeah, sort of a buff guy. He was sort of a buff guy. At least that's the way he looks in the photographs. I mean, you have to recognize, DG, that this generation was, in a basic way, living the immigrant experience, So, they grew up in an American culture, going to American schools. Sometimes in integrated schools, other times in racially segregated schools, but very much living the American culture of the day, by and large. Now, that's not to say that they didn't retain, as every immigrant generation does, or the child generation. I'm a child of an immigrant, and I grew up, eating some German foods and hearing German spoken and so on, because my dad came to the United States from Germany. Well, that's the world that they were living in. They knew Japanese.
Bill Manbo, he's not going. He didn't want to go to after school to learn how to speak Japanese.
No, that's right. I mean, he had only the most basic of Japanese language abilities that he would have had to be able to, pass the salt or, ask for, whatever, something, the kind of stuff a kid would learn to talk to his parents. But he grew up speaking English. English was his first language, and the language in which he was most comfortable. He was an auto mechanic. His wife was a seamstress making dresses for theater companies out in Los Angeles. They were reading Life magazine. They were listening to the big bands. I mean, they were eating, you know, eating the hamburgers and drinking the milkshakes, and they were in the Coca-Cola, and they were living and they were living the American immigrant experience.
Let me just I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the other people, and other immigrants. Well, like your father or people who've come, they have an affection for the old country, or many of them have an affection for their homeland in one way or another, maybe yes. Not to the government or going on, but this is, if they had to choose about what their real home was, there would always be some little bit of ambiguity about it.
Well, I don't think there's necessarily ambiguity about the place you identify as your country. I think the ambiguities arise for many immigrants around this, and it isn't even necessarily a strongly felt ambiguity until you get put in a situation like the Japanese got put into, growing up aware that you have certain connections and certain tastes and certain, whether it be music or whether it be certain foods or whether whatever, that's different from the other kids in your school. You know that was the case for me. You know, my own family situation, my dad was a refugee from Nazi Germany, so my family did not have a great deal of attachment to German culture. My grandmother, you know, notwithstanding what the family endured as German Jews, my grandmother would sit there and quote the poetry of Schiller and Goethe until the cows came home. That was, you know, she took that with her to her deathbed. That's where the complexity arises.
And focus it on Bill. You made me really like this guy, and so he's not thinking about politics in Japan or the emperor or those kinds of things. But he would be loyal to his own Japanese-American community, maybe.
I think Bill Manbo is actually somebody who. You know, he was living in Hollywood. He was not living in a Japanese American neighborhood. He was not dealing
with real
Japanese Americans. His clientele was not a Japanese American clientele. They were living in a multicultural, world.
You've gotten me so involved with Bill Manbo that I'm risking not talking about
the pictures.
The pictures. So let's take a break.
All right.
And read the essays in the book that Eric has edited, and you'll find out more about him. When we come back, we're going to talk about the photographs and what the photographs say to us today. My guest is Eric Muller. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Eric Muller is the editor of a new book published by UNC Press called Colors of Confinement. The subtitle is Rare Kodachrome Photographs of Japanese American Incarceration in World War II. If you joined us late, we've talked about some of the background of this experience right now. Eric, I'd like for you to talk about the photographs. Maybe tell us how you found them and then what you found in them.
Right. So a number of years ago, I got very involved with the development of a new museum that opened up at the site of the Heart Mountain Relocation Center, which was this camp in Northwest Wyoming, where Bill Manbo and his family lived, along with about upwards of 14,000 other Japanese and Japanese Americans. So we're creating this new museum. I was working with former internees from the camp, gathering materials to try to put into the museum. And one of these older gentlemen sent me a DVD with a bunch of photographs that he had been collecting over the years from former internees from that camp. And it was mostly what you would expect, which is to say lots and lots of black and white photographs of, you know, family groups and this and that, camp fences and barracks and so on. And then my eyes fall upon this color photograph, this brilliant, beautiful color photograph, which is now on the cover of the book.
There's just this one, or
in the, there were several. There was the first one that I saw was the one that's now on the cover of the book. And I did sort of a triple take. You know, I had no idea that color photography.
Well, describe the picture.
The photograph is a picture of a group of young women, probably in their, I would say, late teens, maybe, standing in a circle. And the backdrop, they're standing in a big open dusty field, and the backdrop is a barrack at the site of the camp. So you've got this sort of tar paper barrack, and there's a big chimney looming over off on the right, which is the chimney from the communal mess hall where they all would have eaten. But what's unusual about this image is, number one, the women are wearing kimonos. They're not wearing Western attire. They're wearing traditional Japanese attire. And number two, the picture's in color. So the kimonos are just drop-dead gorgeous. They're
amateur photographer, but a professional result.
That's right, a very good photo. So I saw this photograph, and I knew right away that I had something very special here. And that's for both reasons. One of them is simply the fact of color. Many people who have seen these photographs who are accustomed to thinking of World War II as happening in that black and white world, it all of a sudden zooms the past up to the present. It's like you're looking out your own window. You're looking at some people who look like the people who populate our own worlds. And so there's something very present about these photos. They're not marked as history in the same way that black and white usually is, number one. Number two, they're showing some relatively uncommonly depicted stuff going on in these tragic, sad places, which is the open practice of some Japanese culture, number one. And number two, in this particular image, these women are having a pretty good time. They are smiling. They're laughing. Something very humorous has just been said at the moment that Bill Manbo snapped this photograph. So these photos really kind of break open the standard view that we have of the way this episode played out.
It is. It's complicated because those of us who would, in retrospect at least, be horrified at what Americans did to Americans don't want to see that there were any happy aspects of it at all.
And let me just say that, there was a lot of debate between me and the other contributors whom I invited to participate in the project about what image should go on the cover of the book. I had some grave concerns about putting this image on the cover for exactly the reason you just said. It has taken decades of very hard work by many scholars, to document and prove the fundamental injustice and indignity of this experience and the suffering that this community endured. These photographs complicate that story in certain ways because they show something other than just bleakness. They show something other than just grayness. They show something other than just sadness. They show a resilient community, and they show that resilient community in the warmth and the vividness that comes with color rather than black and white. So, you know, there are folks running around out there who think that this is who still think, remarkably, a little bit parallel to what some of the Holocaust revisionism that goes on, who think that these camps were absolutely justified, that Japanese Americans had it good, that that Japanese Americans were placed there for their own protection. That's one chestnut you often hear, that they were placed there for their own good and their own protection. And there is a concern that people will see a photograph like this and they'll say, oh, look at this. Look how happy they were. Look at that. They really were Japanese. They're wearing kimonos. They're not even wearing American clothes. We were justified. The United States was justified in grabbing everyone from age 1 month to 90 years old and throwing them behind barbed wire.
Well, you look for analogies in our experience in the South with respect to plantation life. And so when I was growing up, we glorified plantation life and thought this was the greatest thing in the world with the ladies in the hoop skirts, and mint juleps and all of this. And then the pictures of the enslaved people all, gathering around happy and, having their fun and going to church and all of this. Mm-hmm. Modern scholarship says this is just a terrible representation of what planned. This was a concentration camp. This was hard, brutal, backbreaking, and killing labor. And so one African American scholar just said, "You cannot mention the word plantation because there's just nothing. It's just horrible." Yeah. But you do have to deal with the idea that there were times when the enslaved people, they didn't go around crying about this all the time. They did they did have some happy times together.
Well, I mean, I think, I've spent most of my academic career studying and writing about this episode, the imprisonment of Japanese Americans. And in this book, as in my others, the central fact that emerges from this study is that it's a story of outrageous injustice, that it's a story of Americans engaging in the crassest of racist assumptions about other Americans. It's about hysteria. It's about fear. It's about economic resentments, all of those things. And yet, we have to remember that human beings live human lives, and human beings live resilient lives. And those two things can coexist.
Well,
we're just not accustomed to, it's uncomfortable for us to think of happiness in you know, what people at that time in the United States called a concentration camp. It's hard for us to get those two things coexisting. But we all know from our own lives that we can be happy and sad at the same time. We can be suffering the gravest injustice in our own lives and at the same time finding strength in our families or finding strength in our
communities. Yeah, this is, I mean, this, I don't want to get off the subject, but I mean, all of us have had friends, tragically, who've been suicidal and have committed suicide. And sometimes on the very day that event takes place, they're laughing and joking and really happy for a moment, not just concealing it, but for there are these moments. So it's a, well, now here we've done it again. So tell
what
us.
What do I do to you, DJ?
No. I mean, these are important things to talk about. But talk about two or three of your favorite photographs that are in the book, or those which you think most have a message for us today.
So I mean, you know. Many of the photographs are photographs just like the photographs that you or I would take. And to me, that's very meaningful. So you've got photographs of parades, Boy Scout parades in this camp, you know, behind barbed wire, Boy Scouts with the American flag marching around, drum and bugle corps. You've got photographs of pickup baseball games. You got photographs of a sumo wrestling match, people ice skating. A rainbow ending at the roof of a latrine building, actually. The Heart Mountain Fire Department responding to a mess hall fire. So Bill Manbo, this amateur photographer, is walking around camp, and he's doing with his camera what we do with our cameras, which is documenting our world, catching the things that we find interesting or beautiful or unusual. And really, in a way, he was using his camera to establish some sense of normalcy for himself in these very abnormal circumstances. But among the most moving photographs, of course, are the ones that he takes of his little boy, Billy. Mary and Bill Manbo in 1940 have a little son, and they name him Bill, just like his dad. So Billy is two when he gets to Heart Mountain, and then he turns three and he turns four in camp.
He's a cute little critter, isn't he?
Cute little boy. Loved airplanes, loved model airplanes, so there's lots of photographs of little Billy, and many of them are the kinds of pictures we all take of our kids eating an ice cream cone, playing with marbles and what have you. But then there's the photograph that he takes of little Billy hanging on the barbed wire fence. And when I say hanging, I don't mean hanging like from a noose, but with his hands and feet up on the barbed wire, with the barracks stretching off to infinity behind him. You have little Billy walking along this very lonely road with the huge Heart Mountain looming over the camp and the barracks to the left. You have Bill shooting photographs of guard towers on the hills surrounding the camp.
We take this as a reminder that he wanted to remember that he's confined.
Right. He's not just documenting the pleasant things in his world. He is keenly aware that he's living a life of surveillance. He's living a life of confinement, that it's unjust. And he's using his camera to document that in some basic ways. Yeah.
We're visiting with Law Professor Eric Muller about the book that he edited and put together called Colors of Confinement. It's about the photographs in the Japanese internment camps in World War II. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Alec Mueller. We're talking about Colors of Confinement, rare Kodachrome photographs of Japanese incarceration in World War II. This is a book of photographs that Eric found really sort of hidden away in the attic. And Eric, we talked about all kinds of things here. I want to talk about little Billy. Little Billy is exactly my age. Mm. And so here's the experience of a three-year-old in an internment camp. His daddy's caught him. I see him wearing sort of American military hat, cowboy boots. I mean, he's an airplane, a warplane, maybe.
Yeah.
He's just like I imagine myself to have been during that time. So, What did this confinement experience do to him?
It's a great question. One of the really interesting things about studying this episode is that you get remarkably different experiences based on the age of the person who was confined. So if you were the age of this immigrant generation, these older folks, this was absolute devastation for you. If you were 50, 60, 70 years old, this was pretty much the end of the
world. Your house, home, farm, all gone, everything's gone, nothing to live for.
Nothing to live for. If you are in that, generation that's sort of say late teenager through your 20s, this is also a very devastating time for you because you were just getting started. You might have been hoping to go to college. You might have been hoping to step into the family farming business, whatever it might have been. And this has obviously all been massively, massively complicated for you. But if you were a kid, if you were certainly 2, 3, 4, 5, even up to an early teenager, many, many of those people who are the folks who are still around and able to talk about this actually remember this relatively fondly. They have an awareness now as adults of what their parents and grandparents were going through. But for them, they were able to hang out with other kids. They didn't have to eat dinner with their parents anymore because they were eating in this big old mess hall and they could just go wherever they wanted to. They could run from mess hall to mess hall and get multiple meals. They could go out and chase rattlesnakes and lizards, and they could go, scamper out of camp and under the barbed wire and go over to the Shoshone River and go fishing. This was, for many kids, an adventure, a kind of adventure.
Wow.
So if you talk to little Billy, who's now not so little, and he's not Billy anymore either, he goes by Bill, he has very, very few memories of the camp. But there is an essay in this book by a gentleman named Bacon Sakatani, who's the guy who had sent me the pictures to begin with. He was about 12 when he got to camp. And he writes a lovely essay in this book about what it was like to be 12, 13, 14 years old, what it was like to be in the Boy Scouts, what it was like to roam around camp with a pack of boys causing trouble, what it was like to get put into sports and the Scouts and so on to try to turn them around and keep them from all turning into a bunch of juvenile delinquents. And he has these just absolutely lovely, bittersweet memories.
Wow.
Now, let me just say one thing, though, which is that Japanese culture and Japanese American culture, for that matter, tend to be very loath to talk about things which would be embarrassing or stigmatizing. The folks who survived this experience, who came through this experience, many of them went on to become enormously successful and assimilated. Norman Mineta became the
second. I want to steal this question from you because I wanted to ask you. We're talking in the arena of Simpson Bowles. What does your book have to do with Simpson Bowles?
Well, so there's a connection to Simpson, I'll tell you that. Folks like Norman Mineta, who was imprisoned as a kid at Heart Mountain, went on to become political leaders. He was the Secretary of Transportation, Secretary of Commerce, became deeply friendly over a career with Alan Simpson, the senator.
And where did that friendship
develop? It started at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center. Alan Simpson was a Boy Scout from Cody, Wyoming. Norman Mineta was a Japanese-American Boy Scout at Heart Mountain, and they went on a jamboree together. There's enormous success stories. But the hidden story is that this, as you would expect, this episode left a huge mark on the Japanese-American community.
And we've got a minute or two. What is the message for the rest of us coming out of this book other than it's extremely beautiful and interesting?
One of the basic messages is just how when we get scared, how easy it is to circle the wagons. How easy it is to circle the wagons and put the wrong people on the outside of the circle. We've all been living through the post 9/11 world. There is a strong instinct when you get frightened to identify somebody outside who you feel is outside of your community, and pin a lot of your fear and a lot of your suspicion on them, and to treat them as being somehow fundamentally different and fundamentally outside of the community that's entitled to the protection of rights.
Well.
And that's certainly what happened to Japanese Americans. Many argue that that's what has happened to the Arab and Muslim American community in the United States after 9/11 in various ways, although obviously not through mass incarceration in this way. So I think the message is, however enlightened we may feel our legal system has become, we are still human beings and we are still susceptible to the same kinds of fears that our grandparents got swept away by 70 years ago.
You've been dealing with the second and third generation of people from this experience. In general, do you have a view about whether or not the Japanese Americans are now totally integrated into American life, or are they still in touch with Japanese American communities?
There still are very vibrant Japanese American communities all over the United States. The intermarriage rate between Japanese Americans and non-Japanese Americans is, as I understand it, has historically, since the war at least, or since the 50s, has been the highest of any Asian group. More intermarriage, more marriage outside of the Japanese American community. So nowadays, when you find the later generations, the so-called the Sansei and the Yonsei and the Gosei, these are the names of the numbers of the generations in Japanese, you find people with white parents or black parents or Latino parents or whatever. So it's very much an American story in that sense. But there's still a very strong sense of Japanese American community, Japanese American identity, and the paths of that community run through these camps. And that's why I think this book speaks so loudly to Japanese Americans today.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
A very successful book, Colors of Confinement, edited by our own UNC Law Professor Eric Muller. Thanks.
Thank you, DJ.
Professor Muller. Thanks to all y'all for listening. It's been Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.